You're listening to All the Best. I'm Matilda Fay, filling in for Maddie McQueen. Do you ever feel like the world is just throwing things at you from every angle? Things to do, things to think about and follow up on. And you wish you could just switch it off and go to like a little island in your own head. And then maybe you could find your own rhythm. In this episode, stories of people who drop everything and go off in search of their own little island and the changes that come when they find it. In our first story, Dan takes us to an actual island where he meets someone who found their rhythm in the traditional Japanese drumming style of taiko.
Tokyo is hell in summer. It's hot, muggy, and unrelenting. I needed to get out. I'd already been on the road for more than 15 hours by the time I made it to the island. I traveled on trains, buses, a ferry, and now a last-minute taxi. I was tired and sticky and sick of my heavy backpack. I had made it to Sado, a small remote island about 50 kilometers off the coast of the main island of Japan. Awash in green, with rolling mountain ranges, terraced rice paddies, and jagged cliffs, Sado Island is an incredibly beautiful place. Due to its remote location, it was once a place of exile for fallen emperors and religious figures. But nowadays, it seemed a little sleepy. Other than visiting a few sake breweries or a former gold mine, there's not much else to do, really. I'd gone there to do the Taiko Drum Experience, a Japanese drumming workshop run by the Koto Cultural Foundation. As I stepped out of the taxi and walked through the doors of the wooden taiko center nestled in the hills, I have to admit, I was surprised to see who greeted me there.
My name is Ami Akimoto. I was born in San Francisco, USA, raised in Australia, Melbourne.
Wait, someone from Melbourne? In the middle of the mountains of this small Japanese island? Actually, Ami hadn't been on the island for long. She had recently quit a high-paying job in Melbourne to move there. So that made me wonder, what would make a person do something like that? Why would someone leave it all behind and choose to start a new life in such a remote place? It turns out, it was all about taiko. So, what exactly is taiko?
I've talked to a few people and they described it as, it looks like karate cross music, cross drum, cross sport. So it looks like a martial art, but it's musically entertaining.
Taiko, or wadaiko, is a traditional form of Japanese drumming. In fact, the word taiko just means drum in Japanese. It has a long history and has been used in a number of different musical, cultural, and military settings. Ami has been practicing taiko for more than 15 years now. I asked her how she got into it originally.
The first time I did it, I actually tried it out in the US when I was small, and apparently I loved it so much, but because I was still quite small, and the doctor said that the ear was developing, so it's not good for the ear. I put that on hold, and when I came to Melbourne, I had a chance to taiko again, and I felt rejuvenated because the sound is so simple to make, but it's so innocent.
So fast forward a few years, and Ami was finding that taiko was taking up a larger part of her life.
Taiko was a place where I could actually be myself. That's why I went to work, to pay the money to go to taiko or to do performances with taiko, or I would go to the gym to be strong enough to play taiko. So everything was based around taiko, and I had so much passion for it.
After hearing Ami talk about taiko, I wanted to find out more. So I went to a practice for Wadaiko Rindo, a taiko ensemble in Melbourne, which she was part of before she left. What is it about taiko that has such an effect on a person?
Here I am outside the Anglican church where the taiko group is practicing. And you can probably hear power of the sound inside.
I talked to some of the members of the ensemble, and I asked them why they love doing it so much.
You not only like hear it, but you can feel it coming through the floor, the vibrations move through your whole body. The crowd is just almost entranced and enthralled by this incredible, powerful communal drum.
That was Leah, who's been playing for about 10 years. And here's Jenny, another member of Wodaiko Rindo.
Yeah, I generally, like, my husband says that, like, I come home and it's like, you know, I've been taking drugs or something. I've just got this smile on my face and generally I chatter.
Because it's so simple to play, whatever you're feeling or whatever energy you give to the taiko, it gives back to you. So it's a form of communication that doesn't use any expression in terms of facial expression as such or words. But if you hit the drum with anger, the sound will be full with anger. Or if you hit the sound with joy, it will bring back joy. So it's a way of kind of figuring out how you're feeling and where you are and how people are reacting, and it's like a mirror.
It can feel different ways, actually. It can feel really joyful in a joyful song, or if it's quite a serious song, it can feel quite powerful.
And not only can taiko have an impact on you and the way that you feel, but even on the people watching and listening to it.
Last year's concert, we had an annual concert, shiro concert, and I did the big drum solo, and one of the audience members, she had her grandmother come, and the grandmother had cancer, so she was quite weak. But after the performance, she came and gave me a hug and said, that was so good. I got so much energy from you. Thank you for, you know, giving me the chance to see you." And that's kind of the moments that I love, because, you know, you're not performing for yourself. You're kind of communicating and you're giving your energy in a form called taiko to an audience that loves to see that or gives energy back.
For Ami, her passion for taiko was so strong that she realized she wanted to dedicate her life to it.
The reason why I came to Japan is last year I joined a program that gathers taiko lovers from around the world, and they all came to Sato. And then I met so many people globally who have this same passion, but they struggled with language and they struggled with culture. So for me, knowing both cultures, knowing both languages, it was like, oh, I could actually do much more with what I have and being myself. So that's why I said, okay, I'll just quit engineering, change career, change countries, and start off as, you know, at a new start.
Back in Sato Island, Ami's dedicating her life to spreading her love for taiko around the world.
There's nothing much on the island, and this is where a professional taiko group called Kodo is based. And the reason why they've based it here is that Sato Island is such a community-based place, and taiko is one of the ways that communities bond together, and they wanted to keep that tradition, and that's how it all started out. Now they've made taiko as a performance form, so people globally, people domestically can see taiko on stage and enjoy that. Ultimately, my aim would be to be able to connect people through taiko globally. Being brought up in Australia is very isolated. Although we have a lot of taiko groups in Australia, we still are very isolated from the rest of the world. So I would like to be able to make the taiko community one big community globally, and make it easier for people to communicate and share and collaborate and share their joy for taiko, yeah, with each other, but not for themselves, but for other people, if that makes sense.
So in this little island of exile, Ami's finding a greater sense of connection and community than she ever did before. Her days might move a little slower and her salary's definitely lower, but at least she knows that she's living her life by the beat of her own drum.
That story was produced by Dan Simo. The supervising producer was Jordan Fennell. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Matilda Fay. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be part of the show, you can start by pitching to us at allthebestradio.com. We'll pair you with one of our supervising producers to help you make your story. Sometimes when we change our habits or our surroundings, the shifts that come aren't necessarily happy ones. Things that have been building up in us for years can start to surface, and life can start to get darker rather than brighter. In our next story, Russell's struggles with mental health lead him from a career as a high-flying executive to living in poverty.
Imagine waking up in the morning after a restless night's sleep. Your body hurts, but you haven't done anything. There's this weight on you, and the very thought of getting up and starting your day is just too much to handle. You know you have to work, respond to family members and friends, even people in the street. That's if you manage to leave the house. It's so much effort. You've spent the last few days feeling totally numb. You're confused and you just feel so alone.
When I was young, I didn't believe in depression. And my attitude was, get over it. You know, feel you can't cope, well, you're a bit weak. And it's, you know, or you're a crybaby, or, you know, just... it's very difficult to say when I was most comfortable. I was a suburban solicitor, and I became a suburban solicitor, I think, in 1974, and I absolutely loved it. And my life evolved, so I started off doing custody cases. I did conveyancing, I did workers' comp, I did third-party... and eventually I, through circumstances...
Russell worked a high-profile job that he was passionate about. He had a loving family, a wife, two kids, and a beautiful waterfront home.
I got depression when I was in my 40s, early 40s, and I accepted it, They did all the tests, the doctor did all the tests to make sure I wasn't suffering from dementia. Once I got it, I just accepted it. And at one stage, a doctor said to me, when I needed some time away from something, he said, didn't want to write depression. I said to him, if it's depression, write it, if that's what I've got. So I've never, while I was very cynical about it, once I got it, I accept I have it and never tried to hide it.
Mental health is such a taboo subject that many people fear the label. Though conversations surrounding self-care have become more prevalent, this wasn't always the case.
I was working for Rex and I knew I had to retire, so I'd need a hobby. So what I did is I decided I'd learn French, and I had been learning French off and on, and I decided I'd go to Sydney Uni and study French part-time, which I did.
Though Russell's instinctual response to mental illness was to disregard it, he knew that something was wrong and that needed to change.
And I thought that at my age, I was 65 at the time, they just wouldn't be interested. But it was absolutely the opposite. I was encouraged to apply it.
Depression can be incredibly immobilizing. Through support and hard work, Russ found himself in a position where he finally felt capable of embarking on a new adventure.
The big open space. There's a wrought iron fence, I can imagine, because you like go up the street and past the restaurant in the corner, and then it's a building which is it's very long, with multiple entrances. I think it's brick with a tin roof, not very...
Seeing through the haze of the past few years and feeling somewhat exhilarated by his new surroundings, Russell found himself on a platform in Paris, ready to start studying philosophy and improve his French. What he didn't realise was that he was about to embark on an experience that would put his degree into practice.
I found on the internet a person who was used to hosting students. He was a Frenchman and he had a room. It was a second floor of an apartment near Canal Saint-Martin. And in it, there was two bedrooms, a single bathroom, and there was a kitchen, which I would call a corridor. There was a table where you could put two people. The pantry with all the non-perishables, he actually stored on the Juliet balcony at the end of the kitchen. Only one person could be between the stove and the pantry. And the furniture, if you put it on the street, Vincent de Paul wouldn't take it. It was absolutely dilapidated. The first thing I noticed was that I actually noticed homeless people, because where I live in Sydney, there were no homeless, and I rarely went into the city. So, but in Paris, where I live near Gare de l'Est, there's no there's homeless all around. It's you can't walk down the street without people. So I became very, very aware. For some reason, I can't put my finger on it, but I was attracted to the homeless. That what I thought I'd try and do is that I needed to speak to improve my speaking and listening French, and I thought this is going to reflect my previously appalling attitudes, that they had nothing better to do than to speak to me in French. So I got the idea that I'd, that's how I'd learn to speak French.
Out of his element and curious, Russell found a way to engage with his new city and life. He wasn't quite sure how to go about it, but he was interested in the Parisian people, and he knew that he wanted more.
One day I was in Saint-Michel and a young woman came up to me and said she wanted some money for a baby, and I said no. And then I thought, she speaks good French. So I offered to pay her 10 euros to have a cup of coffee with her. And then she told me about how she lived with her mother in a truck and so on. And she said how she gets food out of the garbage bins. And I'd done gaspillage at Sydney University, which is about how people forage for food. So I asked her if she'd show me. From that, I used to see her every week, and I'd pay her 10 euros to chat to me. I'd buy her cigarettes, and I did that for a couple of months, where that was my interaction. And I learned a fair bit about her, that, where she lived, where she came from in Romania. What I'd do is, when I'd go and see her, and I went to various places with her, I'd make sure that I would empty my pocket. So I took 20 euros at the most, and I would make sure I didn't have a credit card, because I was afraid that she would get money out of me. And what she had is, she had these purple boots with holes in them, and she wanted me to buy a new boots, and I wouldn't. If I have any regret to this day, that I was too miserable and mean to buy her a pair of boots. The first thing is that I think that we need to understand is that no one does it from choice. And I think probably there's two broad categories. There's people who have absolutely nowhere to go. That is, they've got no friends, they've got no relatives, either through violence or for financially or for whatever reason. than a situation where they're destitute.
Working hard on preserving a healthy mind doesn't always come as easily as we think it will. Sometimes the people we least expect are battling the biggest demons.
My case is just one case. Everyone's case is different. But what I did is that I got sick and I put a note on my car and said I was going to sleep on the street and don't look for me. So I didn't take any identification. I pulled all license and HCF card and all out of my pocket and I just took a couple of $100. I was on the street off and on somewhere between a month and 6 weeks because I was on more than once. But not once did anyone come and ask me, you know, what I was doing or did I need help or anything like that.
In a whirlwind of mixed emotions and memories, Russell found himself taking action without processing what those decisions meant. His mental health had gotten to a point where he was no longer able to think clearly.
I had a routine where what I'd do is that I'd get up in the morning and then I'd go across to Matthew Talbot and I'd have breakfast. And then I'd put my gear, or before that I'd put my gear in the homeless bin, which is there. Then I'd go up to the State Library and read the Herald and I'd buy myself a cup of coffee. And then I'd start to wander around the rocks and go to the markets and by the afternoon...
After living on the street for a few weeks without any of his family or friends knowing where he was, Russell was attacked by another man who was sleeping rough. Experiencing quite a severe head injury shocked Russell into contacting his wife for help.
And there's no quick fix for it. It's just, it's taken, I think I spent a couple of months full-time in private rehab hospital. I've had years of psychiatric help because it just takes, it's not repaired quickly. I have a few techniques. First of all, I focus and I can focus on my hand or something. I then start and relax. So I start from my head to my toes and I take relax. Then I go through the colours one by one of the rainbow. And then...
Surfing, family and a series of daily meditation exercises have all assisted Russell in the ability to maintain his mental health.
I see a red fire engine. I see it very, very clearly. Orange. I see an orange sun. I think anyone that's been as sick as I am, I have to be very careful that I monitor how I am. And so I'm very careful that, I make sure I meditate all the time. And I am very conscious, much more attuned to how I feel and how I'm feeling. So I don't assume I'm better. Grass. Blue, I see a really light blue, changing blue ocean. And then I see light purple flowers.
Talise Desiderio produced that story. Ryan Pemberton was the supervising producer. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Erin Dick. I'm Matilda Fay, filling in for our regular host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network. And were made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find all our episodes at allthebestradio.com. And we're also a podcast, so subscribe.